This is Tell Me More, the Sunday magazine on 101.1 More FM, WBEB Philadelphia. I'm Emily Scheibert. Good morning. This week, the impact of substance abuse on relationships with Dr. Denny Carice of the Recovery Centers of America in this edition of Tell Me More. Drug and alcohol addiction can create destruction in all areas of life, as well as the lives of the addict's loved ones. Family dynamics may be greatly impacted, causing damage that may not be easily repaired. Addiction is a disease that doesn't only affect the addicts themselves, but nearly everyone they're in contact with, family, friends, coworkers. Someone abusing drugs or alcohol doesn't stop to reflect on their actions, choices, or consequences. But Dr. Denny Carice, Chief Clinical Officer of the Recovery Centers of America, says that with treatment, there is hope. I asked Dr. Carice to start by talking about one of the latest dangerous drugs that's recently been gaining popularity.
We're hearing more in the news about fentanyl. Can you tell me what that is? Is that an anesthetic, I think?
Well, actually, it is very interesting. We're hearing about not just fentanyl, but another drug that's even much worse called carfentanyl.
Oh.
So it used to be in the 90s that if somebody had a problem with fentanyl, they were anesthesiologists. That's the only person who had access to fentanyl. And there was quite a while where I heard reports of people lacing heroin with fentanyl. And I thought to myself, because it didn't used to be available in the black market, that's odd because it's more expensive than heroin. You usually cut something with another drug that's less expensive. And what turned out was that dealers, you know, people who deal drugs, some of them are very bright. I'm not sure why they don't take all of that and go into legitimate business because they're really good. But they would, you know, when a batch of heroin is put out on the street, it's branded. So let's say it's in a little baggie, it's called Blue Devil, you know. They would lace some of the early batches with fentanyl so that people would overdose and die. Because oddly enough, that has the response in the addicted mind. People say, oh, that's really good stuff. I'm going to get some of that. You know, that's this genetic component. I think your average person would say, oh, you better stay away from that. For the rest of us, those have an addiction piece. It's kind of like, oh, that's really good stuff. We've got to get out there. So what came to pass was the awareness that the fentanyl, which is a synthetic opiate, it's being developed on the black market and being sold. And then carfentanil is an analog of that that is, I think, 1,000 times more potent than morphine. And it is used specifically for knocking out African elephants, 10,000-pound elephants. And it is so strong that even agents that find the drugs on the street or make a bust are afraid to test it because even just getting someone your finger could be deadly. So what's happened now is that carfentanil is being made on the black market, and China just recently agreed to sign off. They were the last country to sign off to agree to curtail the production of illicit carfentanil that's being sold because that's where the U.S. gets their carfentanil from.
When somebody is coming out of the Recovery Centers of America, what role does family play? How important is it to have the family on board? And are people vulnerable to going home back into the same stressors that they left and possibly relapsing because they're back in the same old routine?
Well, one of the best predictors of success is family involvement. Okay, so we try and get family involved right away. The other piece is that in our country, and I have kind of a national perspective of treatment, having been in the research field for so long and then run two other organizations that were 120 and 140 programs across the country. And then I left to do a startup, you know, startup treatment. And I had started treatment in a number of different countries in Iraq, Iran, Nigeria, Nairobi. And I never thought in my country I'd have the chance to start from scratch and say, this is what science says is the best practice. This is what we've seen work. Let's create it to be right. And one of the things about that is that the RCA programs are all kind of in your neighborhood. This idea that we would fly somebody away to Florida for 20, 30, 40 days of inpatient and then fly them back home where they live and where they're going to work and expect them to carry that back with them without the supports and start over in an outpatient is really flawed. You know, the best idea is to have treatment available in your neighborhood and have it be in a campus where you've got detox detoxification or just outpatient, or family services, family education, a family treatment, family program, educational programs, outpatient that's intensive, like 3 hours a day, 3 days a week, or what we call partial hospitalization, 5 days a week, 5 hours a day, so that you can enter that continuum of treatment anywhere that you need, that your family can be involved all across the board in that treatment, both in helping you, but in their own recovery, too, because they need to learn about this as well. And that you can kind of check back in and out when you need different things, whether it's attending a support group at our site for free, or education for free, or if you need more outpatient or to go back to inpatient care, to have that all there so you can get well where you live and work with your family involved.
How satisfying is it to see somebody who's come in so strung out and unhappy, self-hating and addicted, and see them leave with really hope?
Yeah. I mean, that's the dream, you know, to get people into what we call meaningful recovery. And I truly believe that everybody has a shot at meaningful recovery and living the life of their dreams. And it's great when we see them come in and then when we see them leave. But it's even better when we see them come back, you know, 5 years later and they've married and they've had kids and they're, you know, doing well in their life. I mean, that's really the joy.
Talk about a success story, if you would. Can you share the story of somebody that you were personally involved with who had an amazing recovery?
Yeah, sure. There was a young woman who started work at a place I was working at about 20 years ago. And it was early on, and people said, I think she's drinking. And I actually thought she was just depressed. I'm like, no, she's just depressed. I don't think she's drinking. Then it became very clear she was coming in drunk. And I basically showed up at her apartment, and I said, look, I'm in recovery. You know, we want to keep you. You're a great gal, but we got to get you into recovery. And it actually was about 2 hours before she would let me in or open the door. And then I dragged her home to my house to sleep in my guest room that night, and we took her into somebody for an evaluation. The next day, she signed up for intensive outpatient, and she went to intensive outpatient. A couple weeks later, she came back to work and continued in that intensive outpatient, and she's just done beautifully. You know, she's gotten into recovery. She's gotten closer to her family, who wasn't talking to her at the time. She's part of her family, which she was kind of ostracized to begin with. She's done beautifully in her work and her career, and this is, you know, some 15, 18, 20 years later.
So one of your messages at Recovery Centers of America is there is hope.
There absolutely is hope. Treatment works. And another thing that I think is a myth that people say as well, they've been in treatment 3 times, 4 times, 5 times. It's not going to help. You know, they're just here. You know what? You never know which is the one that's going to make it work. And actually, the research shows that the more treatment you've had in the past, the more likely you are that time to get it and to stay sober. I've seen people in recovery meetings and rooms that have been in and out for 10, 15 years that now have 10 years continuous sobriety. So there's always hope. It can always get better.
I wondered if you would speak to how families can reach out to somebody that they think may have developed a drug problem. I think when you are close to somebody, it might be very common to overlook things at first, and then perhaps you start to suspect somebody has a problem. But what would the first red flags be that a family member might be misusing drugs?
Well, the things to look for when you think your loved one is using are things like, have they become more secretive? Do they have periods of either very high energy or very intense sleepfulness that are unusual for them? Have they become hostile or angry? Have they become more withdrawn? Do they have new friends that they didn't have before? And is there any indication that they're getting in trouble at work, for example? So those are different things to look for. And people always ask, you know, well, what should I say? What if I ask them if they're using and they're not? What if you don't ask them and they are, right?
The wakefulness, the sleepiness, the agitation, these would be frontline symptoms. Is this something that is often the case when somebody has maybe come off a surgery or a medical procedure and perhaps they're starting to abuse their pain medicine?
Well, if somebody's on pain medicine from a surgery, they're going to seem unusually sleepy, and that's going to make sense for a very brief while they recover. But the first things you would look for in that kind of case is somebody who starts going to the doctor more frequently, or somebody who changes doctors because their doctor isn't taking their pain seriously or won't give them a prescription. Also, people tend to start doing what we call doctor shopping. That is, they'll go to two or three doctors in a week and get a month-long prescription for opiates. That's a little tougher now than it used to be because there's a prescription monitoring program where physicians can look and see if anybody else has prescribed them opiates, but they're not all using it yet. So additional doctor visits, changing doctors, adding doctors, and then more excessive kind of sleepfulness and kind of seem zoned out when the person really should be getting better.
What's the best way to dialogue with someone in this situation? I can imagine it's very easy to get frustrated and angry and for things to start out as a fight. But if you wanted to have a dialogue, where does one begin?
Yeah, I've told a lot of people, if you think the person has a problem, you see reasons why you think they have a problem, you absolutely need to bring it up. And a really easy way to bring it up is to say something to the effect of, you know, honey, I've noticed you're having trouble doing things that used to come easily for you. What is that about? And just see if that even starts it. Sometimes people are feel so secretive and feel so badly about that, especially if they're a newly drug user and it's the result of prescriptions. They kind of fall into this heavy drug use and getting more prescriptions that they really want somebody to ask them, and they're really ready to talk about it. On the other hand, there's those folks that are just not going to admit to it, and that's a very subtle way of asking about it, and they may get defensive, and then you should just be ready with some examples. You know, I noticed that you've nicked the car a couple times in the past month getting out of the garage, or I've noticed that you have trouble getting up or staying awake past 9 p.m. or, you know, just some things that you've seen behaviorally that you can ask them about specifically.
Do you think that brings an awareness that they may not have even had, that perhaps their drug use has gotten out of control?
It could be if they're really not into an addiction phase, with an addiction being really classified not just by being dependent on the drug physiologically, but by spending a lot more of your time getting the drug, feeling bad about using the drug even when it gets in the way of everyday activities. If they're not at that level, but they're just beginning to misuse the drug, it may bring up an awareness that they just did not have.
We've all heard the term codependency. Has that term fallen out of favor? It always seemed a bit unfair to me that the people around the addict were kind of lumped in as having some sort of disorder. But obviously, the family dynamic changes, the interpersonal dynamic changes when you're close to someone who's addicted. So is that a fair term? Is it still used? And what does it mean?
Well, Emily, it is still used. What it means is a codependent is somebody who really spends vast majority of their time taking care of the other person, really to the extent of not taking care of themselves. So they will frequently do things for the other person, and they feel they either don't have a choice, but it's also more what they also begin to develop an identity around this. So, for example, if you have a husband who's drinking too much and he can't call in sick to work or late to work and you call in for him, if you take care of him and you cover up for him, if this becomes a constant thing where you're always the one kind of taking care of the other person, you know, kind of running interference with their job or any other consequences they might have, that's really kind of a hallmark codependency when you do that to the detriment even of taking care of yourself.
This is something that I think is often found in families where maybe you've had a parent with a similar problem and were protective of them growing up, or saw your mother or father protecting your parent. Is it something that just comes innately to some people, or is this often a learned behavior because of the family of origin?
Well, it is amazing how much our family of origin affects our everyday life, no matter how old we are. So I think that you would be much more likely to take on that role if you watched another parent having that role. You know, if you grew up either watching your mom take care of your dad, or you took care of your parents or whatever, I think it's easier to fall into a relationship that where you have that role. One of the important things to remember, and the reason why we kind of say that the family members have to get treatment for their, you know, disease as well, for their peace of their behavioral components is because it's really tough for these people to say no. They're just not used to it. They don't like it. So going into a codependency group or an Al-Anon kind of group can teach people to say no and to understand when they can make boundaries for themselves. And the important thing to notice, too, though, is that as this becomes more enmeshed, as the person becomes more and more responsible for everything, it is very interesting to watch how when the spouse gets sober, which is what they would have told you they want more than anything in the world, and it's true, and they believe that, but when the spouse gets sober, they kind of lose their job. They lose their importance in life at some level. They lose their role in life. And that's why we say people really have to have their own recovery, even if they weren't the individual with the substance use disorder.
That is an interesting phenomenon because I've heard of it with people who've lost a lot of weight, who've had a spouse who kind of tried to lure them back into their bad old habits. So I can see that the whole relationship needs treatment, not just one of the partners.
That's right. And it doesn't make anybody bad or wrong. It just means that you need some new learned behaviors to replace these behaviors that kind of came automatically to you. So if I'm constantly, cleaning up after you, if I'm constantly taking care of the kids, if I'm the one holding it all together, I lose my role and my purpose when you start holding it together too. And even though these folks truly believe and really do want the other person to get well, they aren't quite ready sometimes for the extent to which they lose their role. They're really kind of like the leader in the relationship at that point, and they're the one, they're kind of the hero. And as much as they'd want to give that up, it's not always easy.
Well, I know that's one of the reasons that Recovery Centers of America believes in giving treatment as close to home as possible so that family can participate.
If you're here and you're in your neighborhood, and we're opening up in a few weeks in Devon, Pennsylvania, down the street from you. If you're here, you're in the neighborhood for detox, for residential, for outpatient, your family can and should be involved from the very first day in both helping with your treatment plan and your helping us understand the patient better, but also in their own recovery. And we have a really significant number of different ways families can be involved, even if their patient, if their loved one isn't a patient with us right now.
There has been such a change, I think, in the public attitude about addiction, and it's a generational one. And I know there are still some parents and grandparents out there who have a really different idea about what maybe abusive drinking or drugging might look like. I think there was a time when people thought if you got up and went to work the next day and were relatively sober at work, anything went at happy hour and after. And
right.
I've seen older generations that are still kind of holding on to that attitude that as long as it's 5 o'clock and happy hour somewhere, you're within your rights to do whatever you want as long as you go to work the next day.
Wow.
This is changing, because of programs like yours putting out a more honest and realistic look at what addiction is and how it impacts families.
Yeah, I mean, there is some change, and it's, we've seen a change in the acceptance of the community or the public on smoking. Even smoking in, open areas is often, not legal now, like in stadiums and whatnot. We're seeing it more with the alcohol. Part of that change has been Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I mean, it was used to be in the 60s, early 70s. You get pulled over for drunk driving, and the officer would say, all right, roll your windows down and just go slow. That's unheard of today. Today,
yeah.
It's taken very seriously, and that was the result of Mothers Against Drunk Driving and their work in the community. So I think things change slowly, but they really are changing. And as we start to see, for example, somebody with 3 DUIs, will get a mandatory sentence. Everybody kind of laughs these things off, and it's really changing quite a bit. I don't think the culture is really tolerating having people be, sloppy and sick and obviously inebriated in public or certainly behind the wheel. So it's changing, but it's not a fast change, right?
You described the kind of respectful, maybe gentle approach to helping somebody see that they have changed and that their using or drinking is really starting to be noticed and impacting their life. And you said sometimes that is met with relief, where somebody says, yes, I've wanted to talk about this and thank you for opening the door. But as you also acknowledged, there's sometimes just hostility, like, well, you have your own bad habits and leave me alone. I don't want to talk about it. So if you are met with hostility in this attempt to dialogue about it with a family member, what's the best approach there?
Right. I mean, I think if the person's got really a new kind of minimal problem, that the more gentle approach is likely to work, and that'll be okay. If somebody's ingrained in an addiction and a significant substance use disorder, you're much more likely to get met with resistance. And there's a number of different things you can do, but at some point you may just want to call an interventionist who does this for a living and who kind of talks with people and talks them through the behaviors and how their behavior is affecting others. And so that may be the best way to go. But you can start also with saying, you know, the amount that you're drinking is very uncomfortable for me, or I'm not comfortable with you smoking pot now that we have children in the house. The really important thing to know is that you don't want to, like, you're not trying to, like, catch them, like, I saw this, or I noticed, you know, you did this the other day, or accuse them. You're trying to bring facts to light for them that show them why you're bothered by it. So, you know, it's a difference between, you know, I hate it when you come home so late after drinking, and saying, you know, when you come home much later than I planned, much later than you told me, because you've been drinking quite a bit, I feel scared that you're something happened to you. I feel hurt that you don't want to be here with me. And it's just really bothering me.
And of course, name calling is the last thing that anybody responds to, because an ugly name like you're a drunk or you're a drug addict, this is not going to end well or in a positive light.
No, it's not. I mean, I have a kind of a theory in life, which is eye on the prize. You know, what's the prize? And the prize in this case is, I'd like this person to understand how their drinking and drugging is impacting me, and how I think it's also impacting their health. But it's usually easier for somebody to hear how it's impacting you if they care about you, if they love you. And sometimes it's easier, rather than saying, you've missed work twice, or you've been late to work twice. Sometimes it's more impactful for somebody for you to say, when you don't come home for dinner and you don't call and I don't know where you are, I feel afraid for you, and I feel hurt that you don't seem to love me enough to tell me. Sometimes that hits a little harder.
And what about the children in the family? I mean, there's very little that kids don't notice that's going on with their parents. And even if they can't articulate it, I think they know. And how do we talk to our kids if their parent might be having a problem with addiction?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that one of the things we found is that kids seem to take responsibility for it. In other words, they'll feel like it's their fault, or they caused it for no reason. Also, you're absolutely right. Kids hear and know more than we ever imagine. So that if there's tension in the marriage around the drinking, if there's frustration when one spouse isn't coming home for dinner, the kids really do see that. They feel it, even if it's never discussed. So I think that by the time somebody goes away for treatment, I think it's time to be pretty open and honest with the kids and to say, your dad has something called a substance use disorder, he or your mom, whichever, to describe it really as a medical illness, and to say that they're going away to get treatment is a sign that they really want to be whole and be back in this family in the way they always were, and they want to get this treated, and that it's something they'll need support for a long time. And you can really easily compare it to other disorders. You know, if mom or dad has diabetes or hypertension, it's just like that. They have to take care of it for the rest of their life, but they're going to be well.
That's so interesting that children self-blame that way. I think there is something there. I don't know if it's just an innate human response or just something peculiar to childhood. But yes, I've seen this in my own life where children, is it because I was bad or because he yelled at me that time or, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Even in cases of a parent dying, kids come up with self-blaming sort of reasons that are not logical. But do you include children in the therapy when you get to the place where the family is called in? And are the kids ever considered too young to participate in that?
Well, we have a couple of different programs for families. We have support groups. We have family education. We have what's called multiple family groups. In the case of the multiple family groups where there's several patients and their families in a group session, which is a very intensive kind of therapy, it's amazing to watch when you have, you know, you'll have a parent, two parents with their kid in there who's 25, and you'll have a 30-year-old in there with, and their spouse is in the multiple family group, and, you know, you'll have all different ranges, and then you'll have a patient who's 60, and all of a sudden the kid who's visiting his parent in treatment, they project onto the patient who's the parent's age. It's really a tremendously impactful way to do therapy, but it's a little tough for kids under maybe 15 or so. When we do individual family work, that's when we could have a younger child in there if it's just the family and the therapist.
I would imagine this really offers a sense of relief to the kids who know something's wrong, and it's painful to have adults not being honest about what's going on. I mean, I have friends who tell me that, oh, we grew up, no one was allowed to say daddy was drunk on the front porch. You know, he would go there and sleep. He wouldn't quite make it in the door. He'd sleep on the porch, but we never talked about it. This was not to be mentioned, and that culture was clear in the family, and that caused them a lot of problems in their own adult lives and in their own relationships. So these addiction problems do have ripples that spread out wide.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And again, what we learn as kids really sticks with us. You know, if you learn that you're not allowed to talk about things when you're unhappy with somebody's behavior, you are much more likely to carry that into your adulthood, even unconsciously. And you're right, kids often think it's their fault that they've done something wrong that has led to this. Just like kids often ask, you know, are you getting divorced because of me? So if somebody grows up, you know, and dad kind of falls asleep on the porch and nobody's allowed to talk about it, or dad breaks a bunch of dishes and nobody can talk about it, that's kind of what you learn growing up. I think one of the really great kind of side effects of the proliferation of the media and movies over the last couple of decades is now you see so many either kind of made for TV movies or TV shows or regular movies that really look at these issues. Whereas before in the 60s, certainly 70s even, we didn't have that. So it's much more likely now that a kid, for example, you know, in the 60s and so kids never knew if they were being touched inappropriately. Now there's so much education on that. There's so many movies out about that and whatnot that kids get. Kids know, you go, hey, you know, don't touch me like that. Well, the same thing is true of addiction and alcoholism and being able to talk about it and say, this looks like, you know, something I saw in that movie. Or, you know, a kid will see that it happens in other families, because that's the big myth for kids, is that they figure it happens in everywhere. So in other words, they just figure your dad comes home and sleeps on the porch too, and they don't realize that it's different or wrong or unhealthy until they get into adulthood, and it's been ingrained in them by that point.
At the Recovery Centers of America, it must be gratifying for you as a director to see families kind of made whole again and see some of these wounds healing. And not just with the identified patient, but with the whole network, you know, with the children, with the spouse.
Anybody you call family will involve. That doesn't have to be, you know, a traditional relative. It can be anybody you say is your support system or your family. And to watch all of them kind of get well together is great.
Dr. Denny Carice, Chief Clinical Officer of the Recovery Centers of America. Dr. Carice says addiction is a chronic disease, not a personal failure. And with help, people beat the disease of heroin, opioid and alcohol addiction with dignity. For more information, go to recoverycentersofamerica.com.
Thanks for joining me this morning. You can email the show or browse the archive. Go to morefmphilly.com and click on Tell Me More. For 101.1 More FM, I'm Emily Scheibert.